Welcome to the Charlotte Readers Podcast, where books and writing topics are center stage and where authors give voice to the written words. I'm Landis Wade. On behalf of my co-host, Hannah LaRue and Sarah Archer, we thank you for listening.
The Charlotte Readers Podcast is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. Listen to your city at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
Hey listeners, this is Sarah Archer. Before we get started with today's show, I have a quick word. Charlotte Readers Podcast now has podcast books. It's true, we have two kinds, fiction and nonfiction. Our fiction book is titled Death by Podcasting, co-written by Landis and me. It's a comedic mystery where we make fun of podcasters and writers in the vein of Only Murders in the Building. It was a lot of fun to write, and it's available in paperback, ebook, and audiobook. We also have 8 nonfiction quote books created from over 500 podcast interviews. The Write Quote series is a collection of inspirational and practical quotes about writing, publishing, and book marketing from the first 4 years of the podcast. The books come with forewords and reflections by Hannah, Landis, and me. They're available in paperback and ebook, and here's a bonus. The first ebook in the series, about the writing life, can be downloaded for free. You can find links for all 9 books at the podcast books page of charlottereaderspodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and if you read our books, thanks for reading. Now let's get on with the show.
In this episode 385, we feature M. Scott Douglas, acclaimed writer and publisher, managing editor at Main Street Rag Publishing Company, and his travel memoir, 8,000 Mile Roll, a story about a motorcycle adventure across America. Joseph Bethanty, former North Carolina poet laureate, says it's impossible to read the memoir and not conjure Steppenwolf's Born to Be Wild, the revving, reverberating anthem to the iconic film Easy Rider. This is a story about the places where Scott went and the people and stories he met along the way, and his perseverance to go 8,000 miles on a motorcycle. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the publication of this book, or better yet, congratulations on making it back after 8,000 miles on a motorcycle.
Yeah, well, I can't say that there weren't some sore moments.
Well, does any sore moment stand out the most?
You know, I'm at that age now when getting up in the morning is sometimes, you know, you have to shake the bones loose a little bit. And I can't say that there wasn't any morning that I got up, because I'm an early riser anyway, where I did not ache. It's like, get me some ibuprofen before I put my butt in the seat, because that's just the way it was. You know, I every day I wake up aching. I had a couple of days where I rode about, 650 miles. The next day was a little bit harder to get up than usual.
Yeah. Well, I've not ridden very far on a motorcycle. I can imagine, though, that being in one position like that for a long time is tough. Let's set the stage for our listeners here. The year is 2021. It's sort of the fading days of the pandemic. You get on a motorcycle and you decide you're going to ride across America. You do have an intermission. I read that in the book. You talked about that. The ride took 24 days, covered 8,001 miles. So you didn't call it the 8,001-mile roll. You called it the 8,000-mile roll. So, but,
well, you know.
But you went 8,000. Yeah, we rounded down. 8,000 miles through 24 states. You went to the Grand Canyon area. You went pretty much, well, you went 8,000 miles. So let's just start out with the basic question. Why?
Well, I spent my whole life I've wanted to ride, to make this trip. I mean, I've seen different movies, different TV shows, and I was inspired by the people who had just gotten on a bike and gone. There's a certain kind of cowboy freedom to that, where you just get up and go. And I've always wanted to do that. But, you know, just like so many other people in America, it's like you have a day job, and many of the day jobs out there, you get 2 weeks a year vacation. It's not the kind of thing that you're going to do in 2 weeks. So I turned 65 years old. I'm semi-retired. And it's like I own my own business. I can set my schedule whenever I want. And I'm thinking, 65 years old, how much more riding time do I have? If not now, when, which, by the way, that phrase was almost the title of the book.
Well, you know, you're a writer, you're a poet, you run a magazine, you run a publishing house. Did you know when you took off that you're going to write about it? Or was that something that occurred to you as you were on the bike?
Well, it always occurs to me when I'm on a bike. I've written, I've had four poetry books out, and two of them were specific to trips that I'd taken on the motorcycle, a lot of motorcycle poems. But every collection I have has at least one or two motorcycle poems. I do get inspired when I'm on the bike because I don't have one of those big bikes that has the sound system and all that. I'm usually riding along inside my own head, and there's a certain rhythm to the road, and it puts a rhythm into whatever I'm thinking. And because I can't write it down or anything, a lot of times I catch a phrase, I see an image, and I will build on it while I'm riding. When I was going through Nevada, there was nobody else on the road. And so it's like, it was easy to think up phrases and all that. I'd done poetry books about this before. And when I got back, I started out trying to do poetry about this trip, and they were all sounding the same as the ones I'd already written. And I thought, no, this isn't doing the trip justice. This is 8,000 miles, a solo ride. There are a couple of people I ran into out there, other bikers, and they said, "You're doing this by yourself?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, mostly because nobody else wants to ride with me." So,
I was interesting when I was reading the book. You didn't have any music. You didn't have a radio. You didn't have one of those headsets, because I see people at these rest stops and they pull in. They've got all the gear. They can talk to each other and behind them, in front of them, they could listen to YouTube or music or whatever. And you didn't do that. And so you were truly in your head for 8,000 miles.
Yeah. You know, I have that equipment. And it never worked for me. First of all, I don't like helmets to begin with, and to make them, like, I have a full face helmet that has a sound system in it, but I hate full face helmets. And, you know, the other ones, if I put the headsets on with my helmet, it doesn't stay in place anyway. It's just, it's uncomfortable. So may as well just listen to the asphalt.
Well, let's talk about the mode of transportation for those who don't know about motorcycling, but at least have this idea of, I suppose, needing to pack light. Tell us about your motorcycle and how you packed enough gear in it to go.
Yeah, that's I started out, I put way too much stuff in there. You know, I was planning, and I'm planning another trip right now. So I was planning to go through the wilderness, and there's so many places you can't really take a motorcycle. So I skipped some of that, but I packed enough stuff initially to camp. I knew that I was going to get some variation in temperatures, especially, when I was in Flagstaff, I woke up to 38 degrees. Unfortunately, that was the 2 days after I had shipped home my jacket, because it was just too damn hot. I mean, when I was going, I almost had a heat stroke when I was in New Mexico, riding through the sun where there was like no place to stop and drink in the Oklahoma Panhandle and into New Mexico. There's not a lot of places to stop. So I packed way too much. I shipped home a sleeping bag, a tent, my jacket, my vest, a set of boots. So I took everything else. I had food with me. I had, several, water containers, you know, to make sure that I had cold water with me, but you'd run through that pretty quickly. But I had everything in case something went wrong. I had tools. I had, you know.
Well, we talked about this at the lead-in for the show here about Steppenwolf, and I'm thinking about the big motorcycles with the handlebars that are way up. So are your handlebars way up, or are they down more at your waist level? What are we looking at here?
Well, they're not way up, but they're called what they're called is mini apes. They're shoulder height. Okay. So yeah, I do have higher handlebars. I that's what I learned to ride on. It's more comfortable for me. Plus I got shoulder issues, and a lot of people think, well, then wouldn't it be more comfortable if your hands were down low? Well, if my hands are down low, then my body goes with it. And that means the weight of my body, you know, my fat belly and all that is on my hands. It was better to have hands up here. Now, if you get too high like this, I don't know how those guys turn.
I don't know. They don't fall over, but yeah, I get it now. It's probably easier on your back to have the hands up just a little
right.
bit. Well, let's talk about the journey itself. You went in some interesting places. Talk about a couple of your favorite settings, because you had your camera with you. You're taking a lot of great pictures. The book is full of the photographs that you took. But in terms of the settings that you visited, just in terms of sheer beauty, what are some that stand out to you?
Beartooth Pass. Beartooth Pass is, it's kind of like on the border of Wyoming and Montana. I stayed in Billings to make this ride. It was really the focal point of the ride. So, you know, I spent a whole day on that. I reserved the 4th of July for that ride and stayed in Billings an extra day in case it rained. You know, cause that ride was really important to me. The other place, Devil's Tower was a nice visit, but the thing is, it's such a, you know, and so was the Grand Canyon, but I wasn't on the bike in the Grand Canyon. Let's see, where else did I go? You know, I could just name a whole bunch of places anywhere in New Mexico. I love Taos. I love Santa Fe. When I was in northern Arizona, and that's where I'm going back in, you know, a few months, there was something really holy about Arizona. It was like it was so hot. But I was by myself and there was really very little traffic around, but you just look off and you every so often you'd see a mesa and it was just a beautiful view and a beautiful place to be alone and, you know, inside your head.
Yeah. That's the Sonoma area, right? Somewhere in that.
No, Sonoma would be southern, you know, that'd be south of
southern. Okay.
Yeah. That'd be south of, southwest in Arizona. I'm looking at when I go back, I'm going back to the Northeast. I'm going to Canyon de Chelly and, Monument, Valley, things like that. I didn't get to take photos of them.
You mentioned the Beartooth Highway, and I read about that in your book, what Charles Kuralt calls the most beautiful stretch of road in America. We went there when we took our kids to Yellowstone. We went to a little place called Red Lodge, which is at the foot of the Beartooth Highway on the side of Billings, and went up and over. And it's fantastic. I mean, I can't imagine what it'd be like on a motorcycle because the views from the car were great too, but it's just it's a winding road up to the top, but when you come back down that other side into Yellowstone, it's spectacular. So I'm glad you got to do that. And
Red Lodge was an interesting place too.
Yeah. What do you remember about Red Lodge?
Well, I felt like when I remember it was 4th of July, and when I went through there, they were starting to mark off all the roads so you couldn't go through there. I was the last vehicle to go through Red Lodge because they were having a parade. And I get to the other side, you know, to the other side of town, they had to like move but I felt like I'm going down Main Street and there's people on the side of the road with folding chairs and coolers and they're sitting there. And I felt like I was the head of the parade. That's like, hey, I guess they knew I was coming.
So was this, once you get out there, all this beautiful scenery, it's one thing. You sort of get transfixed into your environment, but there's probably a lot of road between here and there that can just seem a bit repetitive. How did you deal with the long stretches, and how did you survive that little stretch from Asheville down I-40 through the gap?
Well, I made that with the truck. Yeah, we call that the pass. You know, it's they got that big wall between the east and westbound. the thing about the most of the times when I've gone down through the pass, it's been raining. And going through that place when it's raining is really, you got these truckers that kind of, it's almost like you're driving through a tunnel already, and it's a moving tunnel, so if they leave their lane, you're pinned against that wall. It was a slow morning. There really wasn't anybody else on the road. Once I got past Waynesville, it was pretty much an easy ride through the pass. There were worse places that I went through. So I anticipated it was, the anticipation was worse than reality.
Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit about connecting with Craig Johnson, since we've had him on the podcast. We're not there yet. I want to ask you about other people that you met along the way that you hadn't planned to meet up with, but that you just happened to run into, because you talk about this being, a colorful environment to see in terms of the scenery, but it was probably also colorful to run into people with different, views on the world. Any of those conversations stand out to you in terms of, what you find out there when you actually go out and meet people?
Well, it's funny because I stayed in Buffalo, Wyoming, and the one character I really talked politics with, I mean, I talked politics with a few people here and there, but mostly when I got to Buffalo, Wyoming, I stayed in the in this One Hope Motel, and the guy who wasn't quite the manager, he was like dating the manager. He's an old guy, and he's very, he was scruff. He was, really gruff with me the whole time I was there. But he and I had a conversation because he noticed that most of the conversations actually started with the Steeler logo I have on the windshield of my bike. More people were interested in, my football association than anything else. That started more conversations. I met a guy in Oklahoma who was transporting horses up to Colorado. He wanted to talk about Dallas Cowboys. This guy up in Buffalo, Wyoming, he wanted to talk Pittsburgh Pirates. Oh, you're a Steeler fan. You must be a Pirate fan too. Then there was a group of riders at Devil's Tower who were from Chicago, and they wanted to talk Bears. And, so it was, that was more, I did. People out there really don't want to talk politics at all anyway. They just want to be left alone when it comes down to politics. I think, they say, I got my views, you got yours, just keep it to yourself. Even Craig was that way. So. Mm.
All right, well, it's kind of as a lead-in to Craig. Listeners, you may remember if you've been listening for a while, but for our 100th episode, we had Craig Johnson on the show, and he's a writer of the Walt Longmire series. It's been featured on Netflix for a number of seasons. He's got over 20 novels. I really love his writing. He is a talker, and I imagine when he showed up with his wife, Judy, y'all had a good conversation.
Yeah, we had fun. Judy is like the gatekeeper. And I got that right off the bat. I went in to the Busy Bee and I sat down and I got there before him, and I sat, and you could see him walk into the, in through the door, even with people in front of him, because he's got that big cowboy hat on. So, you could see him before you see him. And I didn't see her right away because she's a lot shorter than him. But when they came in and sat down, I thought, okay, I didn't order any food because I didn't know if this was just coffee and a chat or what. So Judy sits down and she quizzes me about, I think she probably has to watch out for, he probably gets a lot of requests. She's probably is, making sure that, he didn't get hooked up with some weirdo. So when she said, okay, let's order food, I figured I passed the test. But we talked about, to me, having read all the books also and having seen the series a couple of times, I thought, well, the TV series really doesn't follow the books very well. How do you feel about that, Craig? And, Craig can be, he's very, very cleverly elusive on things like that. And I learned a lot just listening to how he eludes the questions he doesn't want to answer, because I interviewed him too later on.
Yeah, he's a good conversationalist, and you asked him a question I read about in the book here about how old Walt Longmire must be now that you've written 20 novels, but he told you what he had told me was he divides his books into seasons so he can get about 4 books in a 1 year of Walt Longmire's life. And
that's he's still been retired for 5 years on that basis, though, you know.
That's true. And then you asked him the question about whether there's any of him and Walt, in which Judy jumps in and says, you know, that Judy keeps saying,
"This is who
about Walt
he wants to be when he grows up."
Yeah. He wants to be when he grows up, yeah. But so you did run into, you know, a writer out there. You kind of planned that. Did you run into any other writers? Because I know you run into a lot of writers, but not writers necessarily.
Well, you know, what I tried to do on that trip and what I'm going to try to do more on the next trip is I wanted that one to be, you know, a writing adventure. But I had, you know, there was an author that I was looking to sign to a contract in Santa Fe. It's one of the reasons why I stayed where I stayed in Santa Fe was because he was just around the corner. So I got to go visit him. Let's see. And I stayed in California. I stayed with one of my authors and, you know, he's edited for me as well. Let's see. Who else did I visit with? Those were the only real intentional stops that I had with authors. There's one character when I was in California. I call him a character because, you know, he's larger than life. I mean, he's just one of these guys that, you know, he's a Vietnam vet. And every time we get together, you know, Steve, the guy I stayed with in California, this is one of his friends. And I met him a few years ago when we published a story of his in an anthology. And we had this party and it's like, holy crap, you get this guy going and he goes from one story to the next story to the next story. It's like, really? Really? You did all that? It's just, I'm in awe of him. So, you know, and I'm like, you want to know who it is? Buy the book.
Okay. Well, look, you know, whenever you take a trip or you plan a trip or something, I know you've got certain expectations for what you want to achieve, but there's always things that happen, things that surprise you. What surprised you on this trip that you didn't expect when you went out in the world on a motorcycle?
I didn't. There were a couple of things. I didn't expect to be so alone. I mean, I left, and it's a solo ride and all that. But I expected to see a lot more riders. I didn't see that many. You know, the ones that I mentioned in the book, I stopped and talked with and all that. I was not expecting. I was trying to be real careful about hydrating properly. So I didn't expect to get dehydrated in New Mexico. The strangers that I ran into, especially in Taos, the one guy, he struck me as like the you know, the patrol, you know, the citizens patrol, you know, I've got my bike along the side of the road, just trying to get some shade. And he comes up and he's like, "What are you doing here?" Just drinking some water, you know, where are you going? You know, it's like, get off my street. So,
right.
But I, you know, I understand that too, you know, cause by the time I got to Taos, I probably looked pretty ragged.
All right. Well, this is Charlotte's podcast. We like to feature some readings from the books. You've got a couple of short sections you selected. You want to set those up as you read them and just whenever you're ready, take it away.
Okay. Well, the first one is, it's a little short intro kind of to chapter 17. Chapter 16 is when I rode through Beartooth Pass. And, you know, it's kind of a recap. But it says a lot about what I think the trip was about, too. So anyway, it's a short piece. Monday morning started gray and cool. Clouds lingering in the mountaintops to the south and west could be seen from the parking lot of the Days Inn as I wiped down the bike and prepared to leave. Today had always been an extra day, a rain delay date built into the schedule in case bad weather prevented me from riding through Beartooth Pass on the 4th of July. Before leaving the top, I remember thinking about the people with whom I would like to have shared a view of Beartooth Pass. But a voice inside said, "The view, not the ride." It was a selfish form of satisfaction that I'd made this trip alone, my decisions, my pace, my experience. That I'd sharing it here in print is one thing. Sharing it there on the road was another. I enjoyed moving through the landscape, if not silently, then with the solemn anonymity that I wasn't the story. The place and its history were the story. I was just a camera lens, a narrator. Oh, there goes a noise I didn't intend. When I was leaving Taos, we had a little adventure the morning and I was leaving the hotel. There was the hotels in Taos, the people in Taos, they tried to keep some of the vagrants off the streets. So some of the hotels are required to allow space for vagrants. And there were a couple addicts upstairs who had a disagreement. And as soon as that transpired, I'm like, I'm out of here. So this picks up on the road. My first stop was Dennis Hopper's grave. Did you know if you key Dennis Hopper's grave into Google Maps, it will take you right there? I was shocked. I'm a fan of his work. Some of the characters he portrayed were unforgettable. I'm sure he has fans worldwide, but to have a satellite in orbit spotlighting where they laid your bones, hot damn, that had to be the coolest thing about dying I ever heard. I don't know what I was expecting, but this sure wasn't it. The cemetery was a poorly maintained gravel lot, about the same size as the other lots nearby where single-family homes had been built. A stucco shed out front had a tilted sign that said, "Office." Behind the building, a field of mostly small headstones stood buffeted by weeds and separated by gravel paths. Dennis Hopper's grave stood out. It was a wooden cross about 7 feet tall, wrapped in so many bandanas, it was hard to read the words carved into it. His name was carved on the crossbeam, birth and death date on the upright below. Atop the cross sat a molded head I'm certain was supposed to be Jesus. It, too, was wrapped in bandanas, as if Jesus had been working out in the gym or riding a motorcycle through the desert. In front of the cross was a ring of what looked like volcanic rocks. Inside the ring was a bed of smaller white quartz stones with a scattering of yellow plastic flowers. Yellow flowers were pinned to the cross also. What interested me most were the trinkets at the base of the cross and one painted rock that said, "Boys, don't get caught watching the paint dry." A quote from Hoosiers. I'd considered leaving one of my stones here, but seeing this shrine changed my mind. I didn't want to desecrate it with personal memento. After taking a bunch of photos, I walked back to where the bike was propped precariously on sandy gravel in front of the office. "Born to be Wild" by Steppenwolf rumbled in my head as I fired up the motorcycle. By the time I turned onto Route 68, Tom Petty was telling me it was time to move on, time to get going. I should mention here that, you know, the stones. On my trip, I left painted rocks. They were like my breadcrumbs to say I'd been there. And I left one down the road a piece, but I didn't leave it there because I thought, it didn't fit.
Yeah, no, I like both of those reads that you picked. The ride alone being one thing, it's like, and in print being another. But in between there was the writing process, which also can be, you know, an alone thing compared to the publication process. So kind of being on your bike riding down the road might be a nice metaphor for being at your desk and writing about being on your bike going down the road, because that's two different things entirely from once you put it out there and put it in print. It becomes a communal thing at that point. Until then, it's just you, the writer, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But, you know, the other thing, too, is I hope that when somebody reads this book, you know, it's a very wordy book. It's a long book. I segmented it by stops, basically, and what happened at these locations. But I think when I'm, you know, I'm trying to portray this, I'm trying to fill this in. I don't know if you can, in print, share a trip like that. I mean, you can't turn the page. Maybe you get a little breeze in your face, but it's not the same as the breeze you're getting when it's, you know, 105 degrees out and you're heading down the highway at 80 mile an hour.
Yeah. But I felt the emotion at the scene of Dennis Hopper's grave and the excitement as well of being there. So that's one thing. Hey, a couple of writing life questions. You've got a publishing company, Main Street Rag, and you've been doing this for a while. You went from a dental career to running a publishing company. Can you give us the Reader's Digest version of how a guy does that, goes from one thing like that to doing what you do?
I spent 22 years as a dental technician, and I was pretty much at a glass ceiling. I wasn't going to go any higher at the business I was at. And I had other people who wanted to sell me the business. But in my mind, the biggest problem about dentistry is dentists. And if I were a lab owner, I would have to deal with them directly. And I would probably chase too many of them off to be able to stay in business. So recognizing that I would not be successful in that field, I thought, well, my wife actually said, look, you better find something else to do with your time or you and I ain't gonna be together for very long. So I've been writing and getting published since I was in my teens. At the time I started Main Street Rag, I was going to start it in the early 90s, but AJ Jelani, started Charlotte Poetry Review, and I didn't feel like it would be, because there wasn't something like that in the area. I thought, well, let's see how he does and support him. And that didn't last. So I have a tattoo on this arm right here that says, because I can. That was one of the reasons why I started a publishing company. I had money. I had the ability to do it. So I did it, you know, and I thought, okay, we'll see how it goes from there. I'd learned from AJ, and I figured I'd give my own spin on it.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad you took that leap. It's something that, you know, that's even more than a leap from going to just, okay, I'm going to be a writer now. You're actually continuing as a writer, but you're taking on this this independent publisher, and now you're having to manage authors. Is that like managing cats? I mean, what is that like anyway?
I think herding cats is easier, personally. I have two cats. They do what I ask. I think the frustrating part for me is because, you know, I try very hard, you know, because I have a personality, and it is a gruff personality. And I try very hard to treat people as intelligent human beings until they prove otherwise. And sometimes I just sit there and I think, okay, as a writer, you don't decide you're going to be a writer unless you're a reader, right? So I tried very hard to give simple instructions, but you know, when we started a magazine, I had three sentences. That was my guidelines. And I couldn't get people to follow three sentences. So it just kept growing and growing and growing until right now it's like annoying. I think some authors are easier to work with, and I'm easier to work with them, you know, because it's like they understand what I'm trying to do and I understand they're helping out. You know, some people, they expect me to do everything, and they don't feel any need to help. And that,
yeah, I think that's one of the, that is one of the misconceptions, I think. And in part because people aren't, when you get into it and you're writing your first couple of pieces, you don't fully understand what the industry is like and what the business is. And it takes, I think, authors a time to realize, and we preach on this podcast, look, you know, publishing the book is kind of like the beginning. You got to get out there and tell people about it. You got to get involved in helping your publisher promote the book and everything else.
Well, the truth of the matter is, and this is one of the things that I, you know, I look for these days, you know, because I have other people who help read and select the manuscripts we're going to publish. I look at their presence. You know, 80% of my books are sold online. So if you don't have an online presence, what help are you going to be for sales after the book goes to press, or even leading up to the book going to press? So that's a, you know, that's a qualification I look for. Do you have a presence? Do you have a following? I think the misconception that some authors have is, well, I'll set up social media after I get the book started. You should be on social media. I don't, take your pick, Facebook, whatever. You should be building an email list before you have something you want to sell somebody. You know, because if you wait till then,
yeah, that's,
it's hard to sell it at that point.
It is. And it's hard for people to get their head around that, but it's true. It's absolutely true. You've got to have a platform. You've got to get out there and market yourself. And much as I don't like social media, it's one of those evils that we've got well, to, you know, try to embrace.
That's something that's funny too, because, you know, people like Craig, you know, Craig doesn't usually do his own social media, and Zahn McLarnon, I know he absolutely hates social media. You know who Zahn is? He absolutely hates social media, and so, you know, he's not on there, and I tolerate it. I have fun on it. I mean, I used to get up there and do all the political stuff that everybody else is doing. But now it's like, you know, I think what we need, okay, I may agree with this person or I may not agree with that person, but you're not going to convince anybody either way. So I'm just going to have fun with it. If you really think that, here's my little joke about that thought or whatever.
Yeah. And you mentioned Craig, another thing he does, and authors can do this too. It doesn't have to be you're on social media every day and you're politicizing or whatever, but you can do different kinds of things. I mean, I know that Craig Johnson, though he probably has somebody running his Facebook, every Christmas he puts out a Christmas story and sends it out to his email list. And a lot of people look forward to that, you know, and they stay on his email list, and he grows it because people say, hey, look at this. It's a short story, involves the characters from his books, and it's a lot of fun. So authors can do that kind of thing too without having to become day-to-day social media.
I don't know much of that is him, but he's a great marketer.
Yeah. Last question. If you could tell your younger writer self something of value, based on everything you've learned since then, that had you known it then might have helped you as a younger writer, what would it be?
Wow. I don't know. I mean, damn, there were so many points in my life that I screwed up. I think if you go all the way back to when I was in my teens and all that, and I started writing poetry, you know, as a teenager, you're writing love poetry to try and impress the girls, you know. It's like, I think I would have skipped that stage. You know, I got involved with girls maybe a little too early. Other than that, I don't know. I mean, I've made plenty of mistakes. I'll probably make plenty more, and, you know, whatever time I have left. But, you know, here's a phrase that I found out most people hate, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. No, mistakes is part of the process. All right, listeners, 8,000 Mile Roll, it's out there. It's rolling along. Check it out. He's also got something called Living in a Red State Blues. That's a little poetry
that's
book.
That's my last poetry.
I picked up and started. Yeah, that's his last poetry book. I started reading that. It's really, some really good stuff in there, too. And you can check him out at Main Street Rag Publishing. also on our website and so forth. Scott, it's been great having you on the show, buddy.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Hey, folks, as we wrap up another episode, we just want to say thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here, and we hope you enjoyed the show. We also hope you'll join our community. To do that, feel free to poke around our website, charlottereaderspodcast.com. The best way to stay in touch is to sign up for our twice monthly newsletter, and you can do that via the contact page on the website. We won't spam you. That takes way too much time. We're not going to do that. You can also use our website to read our community blog and show notes, submit an elevator pitch to be played on the show, submit a blog post, give us feedback, submit to be on the show, become a Patreon supporter, and to see what's coming up on the show next, order our podcast books, or listen to previous episodes. So many things, and the best part, it's all free. Until the next episode, this is Hannah LaRue, and on behalf of Sarah Archer and Landis Wade, read on, ride on, and rock on.